This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Friday, February 12th. I'm Angela Denning. Petersburg police are searching for an inmate who escaped from the Petersburg jail this morning. Police reported the escape of 22-year-old Jacob Sturgeon just before 11 o'clock this morning. He reportedly removed his shirt and shoes while running past the borough's public works shop on South 2nd Street. Sturgeon was described as 5'9", 180 pounds, with brown hair. Sturgeon was in custody and charged with 2 counts of assault and 1 count of resisting arrest. According to a court document, police attempted to arrest Sturgeon last Friday at a residence on Lumber Street following a report of an assault. Police allege he pushed down the officer and ran into the wooded area behind Lumber Street at the time. Sturgeon had a bail hearing this morning, and his bail was maintained at $500. Sturgeon called into the bail hearing from the jail shortly before his escape. The elementary school has been on lockdown this morning during the search. KFSK will bring you more on the story throughout the day. And the latest we have on this is he was seen up Hammer Slough wearing very baggy sweatpants and not wearing a shirt or his shoes. If you have any information that might be helpful, please contact the Petersburg Police. That number, 772-3838. The Petersburg School District is dealing with more money than it anticipated going into the school year and will be using some of the money to take care of capital project needs around the campus. The school board Tuesday approved a revised budget and also okayed the purchase of new software for the district's finance office. Joe Vicknicki reports.
The overall enrollment number at Petersburg Schools is up this year, over 460 students. Last year, enrollment was 431. The district budgeted for 442 this year. Those additional kids bring with them more state funding, but the district has not been hiring more staff yet. School Superintendent Erica Clute-Painter told the board that the schools have too few teachers.
It's a tricky time because in this crazy budget world right now, we have been so reluctant to overstaff that we're understaffed.
For the last two years.
And it's, you know, it's starting to show. So it's going to be, it's kind of a tricky position to be in, because we're very fiscally aware of what's going on, but we're also understaffed.
Clute-Painter said teachers have increased their workloads to make up for those additional students. The problem, she explained, is that students have come into the district throughout the year and in all grades.
We've had people ask, well, you know, if they've come in and you feel that you're understaffed, why aren't you addressing that? And the problem with that is it's not that simple, as you guys could imagine, too. You know, you don't get all of your kids don't all come in as fourth graders, where you could say, okay, we need to hire a fourth grade teacher and we're going to have that new class start in October. It doesn't work.
A proposed budget revision for this school year has increased spending by more than $500,000, with funding for more equipment and staff travel, additional teaching supplies, new musical instruments, and choir risers, to name a few. However, more than half of that increase, $300,000, will be transferred into capital projects. Specifically, staff wants to set aside $85,000 for new accounting software, $100,000 for a new phone system, and $115,000 to improve wheelchair accessibility in the schools. Even with that increased spending, the district has a problem of too much money in its accounts this year. The school's ending fund balance from last year is actually bigger than the district thought because of a revised payment amount paid by the state into the teacher retirement system. The schools are only allowed to keep up to 10% of their operating budget in reserve, and Finance Director Karen Quitzlin explained the schools are currently above that limit.
So overall, our ending fund balance is $1.1 million, which, you know, we're capped at the 10%, which would be $895,000. So we are carrying a larger fund balance than what we really should be.
Quitzlin explained the schools will have to spend more money or transfer it into other capital projects in order to get below that 10% limit.
We are hoping that the board will work with us and do a work session so we can plan for the next budget revision and have a better idea of what the board identifies as the needs for the district when we're talking capital.
Quitzlin said she expected at least 2 more revisions to this year's spending plan. The board approved those changes Tuesday by a 5-0 vote. In related news, the vote was also unanimous to purchase that new accounting software. The purchase is paid for with some of the money set aside for capital projects. The new software will replace a computer program the district has been using for 35 years. Quitzlin told the board the new software would eliminate some time-consuming data entry work, and she thought it would make employees more efficient.
Maybe I pick up some other tasks that some people in our district are currently doing, but they're overloaded in their workload. Mm-hmm. So it's really about when you're balancing out efficiency and cost, I think this is a cost-effective program. And it's not something that is an impulse decision. I've been thinking about this for over a year.
School board members questioned Quitzlin about the $80,000 price tag and the additional $10,000 a year that the software support will cost. Here's board member Jay Lister.
I guess my only question is it, are we buying a Mercedes program or are we buying a Chevy? We don't have anything to compare it to. Mm-hmm. Are there ones out there that are $10,000 that do most everything we need, but not quite as nice? Or is this like the nicest one that there is out there available?
Quitzlin responded she thought the price was reasonable, and board members agreed to spend that money. The hope is to have the new accounting software in place with staff trained on it in time for the fiscal year that starts up in July. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Petersburg School Board also this week heard the results of a risk behavior survey that was given to high school students 1 year ago. High school and middle school principal Rick Dormer said 109 of 147 students in the high school took the survey in January of 2015. He outlined some of the findings to the board.
Kids trying marijuana came up. In the high school, it said about a third of our kids, 10% of them before the age of 13. That was an alarming statistic that we wanted to talk about and address further with staff. Kids trying alcohol is at 63%, and as well as inhalants and other drugs, was higher than the state average. It was around 10%. But that still obviously was a concern and something we wanted to talk about with staff and talk about ways to investigate.
Dormer also saw concerns with tobacco use, cyberbullying, and kids who thought about or have attempted suicide.
And this is attempted suicide in our schools was, in the high school was 6.6% report on the survey, which obviously anything over zero there is unacceptable. Thoughts about suicide, 18%, and students who had actually planned to commit suicide was 20% in the high school. This is January 2015. So those are extremely alarming.
As for positive results, local students are involved in physical activity and eating healthy foods at a much higher rate than the state average. Board President Sarah Holmgren thought it was good to hear the survey results, and she remarked on how education has changed.
All the time spent analyzing it and talking about it, I know, doesn't have a direct link to academics, which is really what school is about,
yeah.
And yet our teachers and staff are taking on this other ball of wax in order to help kids learn that.
The survey is paid for by the district's Healthy Living Grant from the state. Middle school students were also surveyed, although the district has been told those results will not be available until this summer. Scientists have documented two biotoxins in Alaska's marine mammal population above the Arctic Circle for the first time. That's according to a new study out yesterday in the journal Harmful Algae. But as KNOM's Emily Schwing reports, it's not clear if the toxins have always existed in the Arctic because scientists haven't looked for them before.
Scientists didn't expect to find algal toxins in ocean water or marine mammals that range north of the Gulf of Alaska or the state's southeast region.
This is really important because these are animals that are integral to the culture and the community and food security here in Alaska.
Dr. Frances Gulland is a commissioner with the Federal Marine Mammal Commission. She also co-authored the new study.
There are detectable levels that have actually been measured of two different biotoxins, domoic acid and saxitoxin. And both these are toxins produced by harmful algal blooms.
The two are known to cause amnesic shellfish disorder and paralytic shellfish disorder in people. Gay Sheffield is a biologist with the Alaska Sea Grant's Marine Advisory Program. She's also a study co-author.
Now that we see that algae is there, what would be the best course of action to make it comprehensive knowledge is to find out how our Russian neighbors have seen any of these unusual algaes or unusual you know, if they have any unusual concerns. And more importantly, is there a traditional knowledge on shellfish poisoning or algal blooms or strange behavioral events with marine mammals?
After algae die in the ocean, what's left gets consumed or filtered by shellfish like clams and mussels, staple foods for many marine mammals. So if there are algal toxins present, they could end up in the gut contents of an unsuspecting Pacific walrus, for example. Sheffield says of the 13 marine mammal species sampled over the course of nearly a decade, walrus had the highest levels of algal toxins.
And because it's such an important subsistence food item for the Bering Strait, there's of course interest both from an animal health perspective, but a public health, human health, food security as well. But right now, there's no problem.
According to the study, levels of algal toxins measured don't exceed regulatory limits for seafood safety in Alaska or at the federal level. It's also not clear if the toxins have always been present in the far north, because scientists never tested for them before now. Francis Gulland adds that the study isn't only limited in size, but the data itself can't provide information about the magnitude of exposure, because toxins like domoic acid are cleared from an animal's bloodstream or its gastrointestinal system so quickly.
So if you think about it, if the animal ate some food 10 minutes ago that was full of domoic acid, it would have a high level. But if it's 12 hours since the animal ate, the levels will be lower. If it was 2 days since the animal ate, they may be really low. So really, the data are limited because they're only telling you what's there at that snapshot in time.
Research does indicate an increase in the occurrence of algal blooms in the Arctic. Gulland believes that's due to warming ocean temperatures and changes in sea ice extent.
The plants, they grow, they are temperature dependent, so clearly with warmer waters, they're going to replicate quicker. So it's sensible to assume that temperature is important. But there are also changes in micronutrients, things like iron and different components of water that will affect how they bloom as well.
Funding for study sampling came from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Additional money came from the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation. I'm Emily Schwing in Nome.
Ketchikan's Women in Safe Homes has been on probation since last fall after a site visit by the State Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault found the emergency shelter out of compliance with various regulations. WISH officials, though, say there was no warning from the State Council that there were any problems. In fact, just a few months prior, the shelter had received notice of compliance, praising the program for following regulations. Lila Carey has more from Ketchikan.
In summer of 2015, a representative of the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault conducted a site visit of Ketchikan's emergency shelter. Women in Safe Homes board member Joel Jackson says that representative also attended a WISH board meeting.
At that board meeting, several members of the board asked if they had any questions or concerns or anything they want to share with us, and they did not.
In fact, a letter from CDVSA dated June 4th announces that the WISH program complied with all regulations. It states that, quote, "The review of your submitted policies and procedures reveals that WISH is operating in a professional and responsible manner, providing a high level of quality service to residents in the Ketchikan community and surrounding areas," end quote. About 3 months later, WISH was placed on probation by CDVSA for not following policies and procedures. So what happened in those 3 months? Jackson says the board has asked that question too, and received no clear answer. CDVSA Executive Director Lori Morton did not respond directly to requests for an interview for this report. She instead emailed a statement through Alaska State Troopers spokeswoman Beth Ibsen. In the statement, Morton writes that the agencies are working together to get WISH into compliance. The September site visit report from CDVSA notes procedural issues such as excluding clients who are under the influence, a lack of cooperation with other local service agencies, a violation of record-keeping regulations, and a lack of training for board and staff. WISH board chair Carla Reinhart says that WISH disagrees with findings in the report.
And we did try to appeal, and we were told we could not appeal. And we feel like we were not given, either the board or the staff members were not given the opportunity to address the concerns. And if we could have had open dialogue from the beginning, a lot of this could have been avoided.
But with CDVSA holding some large purse strings, WISH has little choice but to work through remediation steps that the State Council has laid out, such as establishing a planning process, improving training procedures, establishing operating agreements with other service agencies, and following a grievance process for employees who've been let go. Jackson says many of those steps have been accomplished. Some were done before WISH was put on probation. The planning process, for example, took place last spring with assistance from a 4-acre group expert.
And that happened before they even wrote this out as a problem. And so that's why it's really, you know, it's hard to understand where this came from, because that information was available to CDVSA in advance of this report.
Among the issues noted in the documents is a practice at WISH of excluding people if they're under the influence of alcohol or other substances. The CDVSA report states that people in a domestic violence situation often have co-concurring conditions, including substance abuse and behavioral health issues. According to the State Council, such conditions should not be used as a reason to keep people out of a shelter. WISH board member Jamie Palmer says that Ketchikan's shelter does not reject people because they're under the influence of alcohol or drugs. She says advocates who notice a client is somewhat inebriated will counsel the client and assess their condition.
And if the advocate deems they're okay and safe to stay, then they would be able to stay in the front of the shelter.
Those clients can go into the main part of the shelter after they're completely sober. People under the influence to a level that they're a danger to themselves or others are referred elsewhere, either to the hospital or law enforcement. But Palmer says when they are able to safely return to the shelter, they will be allowed in. Palmer admits that there was a time period when an employee interpreted the policies incorrectly.
We had a new shelter manager fresh out the gate, and she needed that training, and she took it in her own way, and she's no longer working there. Okay. So she was let go pretty quickly after those things were brought to light.
During the 9-month probationary period, which lasts through June, women in safe homes will continue to get funding from CDVSA, but it's through a monthly reimbursement. Jackson says that's been challenging for the nonprofit agency.
As a small agency with limited resources, that makes it very difficult to operate. It also, as some have pointed out, puts at jeopardy other funding, because other funders will look at that and go, why are you on probation?
That's exactly what happened at a recent Ketchikan City Council meeting. The council approved a list of grants to local nonprofit agencies, but delayed the $16,500 grant to WISH, citing its probationary status. WISH officials do plan to attend the next city council meeting to give a presentation and answer any questions about the shelter's program policies and procedures. Jackson says the WISH board hopes to be taken off of probation sooner than the 9-month time frame set by CDVSA, so that shelter officials can put their time and energy toward other projects.
WISH is trying very hard to raise money for a new shelter, and has other things that we need to work on, and this is taking in an inordinate amount of staff time and obviously the board's time as well to address, and the fact that we're talking to you when we could be talking about fundraising events that we're doing and mm-hmm. you know, and things that are more positive.
WISH serves southern Southeast Alaska, providing emergency shelter for people in Ketchikan, Saxman, Metlakatla, and Prince of Wales Island, and it also takes clients from Wrangell and Petersburg. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.